Our next speaker is Dr. Elwin Taylor. He's recognized throughout Iowa, and I might add throughout the country, for his extraordinary efforts as an extension educator. He's received the Iowa Distinguished Service to Agriculture Award. He's internationally known as a scholar of biometeorology, and he served as a technical editor of several international journals on meteorology. His contributions to the threefold mission of the land-grant university system, research, teaching, and extension demonstrate the breadth of his interest, ability, and expertise. He's received the Excellence in Extension Education and the Excellence in Economic Education Awards. He's received the Iowa Regents Professional Achievement Award. In 2003, he received the Distinguished Service to Agriculture Award from the Iowa Farm Bureau. He's responsible for statewide leadership in the development and implementation of extension education and informational programs on agricultural climatology. He also has some teaching responsibilities both at the graduate and undergraduate level. Unfortunately, Dr. Taylor was unable to physically be with us today. His presentation is pre-recorded. So if you do have questions specifically for Dr. Taylor, his email address is provided on the final slide, and I would encourage you to just email questions to Dr. Taylor individually.
The climate is changing. Climate has always changed and will always change. The question is how much, how fast, and how come? This statement by the leading climatologist on our Earth in 1966, when I was a graduate student. That was the question in 1966. That still is. And we look at climate and what it's going on, and people are saying this may be worse than something we've seen in a long time. The U.S. Drought Monitor, the most recent one at the time that I put these slides together, at least, shows a large portion of the country in drought. And when you look carefully at the monitor with its harshest droughts centered right over the area of Nebraska, where they make the drought monitor, by the way, you see some little letters describing the type of drought. Some of the letters are S's, meaning short-term drought. Some are L's, meaning long-term drought. And some are S's and L's, meaning both kinds of drought are there. Well, we have always recognized that there are two kinds of drought. Well, I say always, maybe not always, but at least back into Old Testament times, if we read in the book of Kings in the Old Bible or in the book of Amos, you will read about a drought for want of food or a drought for want of water, that is, agricultural drought and hydrologic drought, or as we now call them, short-term and long-term drought, so-called because the short-term usually happens first. The precipitation becomes light or absent, or perhaps the temperatures become high so that crops and plants in general require more water than usual. Rule of thumb, the amount of water demand by a field of crops doubles with every 10-degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature. And so we can get a drought with even normal precipitation. On the slide, you're seeing in the lower right-hand corner the long-term drought. Where it's green, there is no drought. Where it's shades of rusty color, there is long-term drought. That is a lack of water in the rivers, the wells that furnish water perhaps to whole cities as well as to local residents that have perhaps a farm well. And the ponds are likely to be low on water also. The long-term drought does not begin to correct until the agricultural drought in the locality is completely corrected. That is, enough precipitation has fallen that the soil, subsoil we're speaking of here, has become fully recharged with water to its capacity. Then the excess moisture, should another inch or two of water fall on the soil, will either run off the surface or percolate into the soil and percolate right out the bottom into the wells, or perhaps through drainage tile on agricultural land, or in some other way, reach into the ponds or the established flow of rivers. We will not sustain the flow of rivers until the agricultural drought along the rivers, tributaries at least, has been corrected. On the lower left, we see the short-term drought, green areas where there is none because of recent precipitation in most cases, and in the center of the country, some wide areas that is not serious at this time, so they would say, and some locations where the short-term drought is still significant. The Department of Agriculture put out a slide that showed almost all of the country painted red. And those are the counties that were eligible for federal disaster relief, in whatever case federal disaster relief happened to exist during the past year. And the counties with no color in them were not eligible. The red were, the yellow, yes, because they are bordering the drought counties. Well, this is as much drought area as we have ever seen, perhaps the most that we have ever had in the country. But that doesn't mean it was the most serious drought. It is just serious now by our current way of categorizing what is a drought and what is an emergency. Nevertheless, the water year, in the next slide, was shy of moisture in much of the Midwest. I give one example from the center of Iowa, where I happen to live, that has three red arrows showing 3 years since 1950 when the water for the water year, that begins October 1st, because we assume that water that falls after October 1st is adding in to the coming year's water supply for both crops and for rivers and lakes. So the water year, about as low in 2012 as it was in 1998, or as it was in 1956. These were the two very short years of water that we have had since 1950. Oh, yes, there were a couple of equivalents in the 50 years before as well. A couple of things that I want us to notice from this. First, there is an increasing trend in the amount of moisture for the year, about 10% increase since 1970. This is general over the Corn Belt, not really general over the 48 states, but general over the Corn Belt, and has caused considerable change in the climate, able to raise soybeans without irrigation sometimes in South Dakota, as unheard of as that has been, and unbelievable it would have been 20 years ago. But I want you to notice a couple of things about those three arrows. The bad year for driest was not the first dry year in any of the cases, including the one for 2012. And it was not likely the end of the droughty precipitation part of the weather. It tends to go on for another year, or maybe two. In every case that we have observed, at least, of this short of a water year, it's such a big event in the atmosphere of our planet to get this type of a year that it takes months, if not 1 year plus, to get out of the driest and back to normal. And the normal line is on the chart. Also, you see a couple of years that were very wet, and it doesn't take multi-years to get out of the very wet years because there's a very different cause for them. When we look at the 48 states as a whole, we see a very large difference that happened in our country as we've shifted from one type of airflow to another. The top chart shows October of 2009, a map of the country, typical of an El Nino in the way it's configured, although this was a rather strong one, for the precipitation that fell in October of 2009. Quite dry in Arizona, adjacent Nevada and California, New Mexico, Utah, parts of Colorado, and much of the state of Nevada, and sort of dry in some other places, all the way down the Rio Grande River to the south end of Texas, for example. Florida and North Carolina, dry. That was significant. Those areas, especially in the Carolinas, will begin to expand soon after this month of October. But you, for the most part, see it was very wet in Southern California compared to usual, and very wet in the Midwest. And there was a little bit of water in some of the areas of Montana. Then there was a shift from El Nino conditions for our planet to La Nina, the opposite condition. We usually consider El Nino the friend of the Midwest farmer and not the friend of the farmland or ranchland of the state of Washington, Idaho, Montana, and some adjacent areas in Canada and in the U.S. as well. But we shifted to the La Nina. This put an end to the conditions of more than 3 years of El Nino-like condition, but was rather dry for parts of the Canadian Prairie and for Montana, and things got a little bit rough up there, but then it shifted to the La Nina-type situation, went dry from Texas to Florida and north into part of Canada, but the wet area that developed in Nevada, well, people thought they were going to drown in the Death Valley area and on the Utah border with Arizona, and the precipitation began to become excessive as we went into Montana, Idaho, and Washington, though it doesn't show yet in October. It will be excessive enough that the drainage out of that area will cause significant flooding during 2011 as we go down the Missouri River from Montana through North Dakota, South Dakota, along the west border of Iowa, and the east border, of course, of Nebraska and Kansas, and then across Missouri. And the floods would be significant with that. Well, these two events will show in a graphic form, with El Nino in the green at the bottom of the slide, and La Nina, a trouble causer for the past 3 years in our 48-state area at least, as well as much of the world, and the red area at the top, or perhaps it's pink. We moved from dominated by El Nino at the lower left portion of the graph, that by the time we were through August, had shifted into a La Nina, which peaked on October the 10th, 2010, as the second strongest La Nina event in recorded history. Well, it's 130 years recorded history, and it stayed at that high level for some period of time. Then it wavered in 2011 and came back by the time we were to December of 2011, enough to keep the atmosphere of the planet in La Nina conditions. The La Nina officially ended on the 21st of March, 2012, but the weather conditions of the planet still persisted in that condition that brought the drought that we had in many parts of the Midwest and the Deep South until, well, recently. It was still somewhat present. We had hoped that the shift was going to be right into the El Nino. It didn't make it. And now, the end of the chart, we see that we're smack in the middle of neutral conditions and expected to stay in neutral conditions, at least for a few months. But let's look at the picture of the risk that goes along with the La Nina we have been experiencing. The left-hand map shows blue at the top along the Canadian border. That is temperature for January, February, March, colder than usual. So winters are usually cold there, but this is even colder than usual when La Nina is going on. White is about normal, and from Florida to Texas and up the Ohio River Valley area and in between is likely to be on the warm side as usual in a La Nina winter. On the right, we see the precipitation, likely to be very heavy in Montana, and it was, likely to be above usual in the Ohio River Valley, though the Ohio and southern Indiana and adjacent areas of the country, Tennessee, Kentucky, and perhaps down the river all the way to Louisiana, and drier than usual in Texas, and indeed with this very strong La Nina, it was drier than usual, drier than any year for Texas since 1955-56 drought, which was worse than the one that we had a year ago. Maybe not worse in dollars, but worse for the meteorological measurements and the climate conditions. The risks that we see that affect the Midwest are associated with El Nino, we'll see on our next chart. And on this chart, we'll see a red area in the ocean off the west coast of South America. That warmer than usual water, with colder than usual water showing up as blue north of Australia, is typical of the El Nino event. And in the upper right corner of our slides, we can see the risk wheel. The chance of having a record high yield during an El Nino, this is for U.S. corn production, by the way, is the green area in the risk wheel. The yellow area in the risk wheel is above trend line yield, but still not record high yield. Blue is below trend, but not drought. Red is drought. With an El Nino, there's a 70% chance that our nation will enjoy a corn yield above the trend line, and really a pretty good chance it might set a record high yield. The opposite of El Nino is La Nina, where the water is colder than usual off the west coast of South America along the equator, and north of Australia it is warmer than usual. When we have this condition, we have a 70% chance of a below trend line yield. On the graphic, I have put in the trend line yield, where yellow meets blue, 160 bushels the acre. If we have normal weather across the nation in 2013, we would expect to have a normal yield or a trend line yield of near 160 bushels. However, the more likely yield, if an El Nino is going on, is 147 bushels the acre. And the chance of a drought being less than 144 bushels the acre for corn is very significant. Of course, in 2012, the corn yield was 123.4 bushels the acre, according to the USDA, right in the middle of the serious drought. But still a 70% chance of being below trend in a La Nina year. The current picture of what's going on with ocean temperatures, the next slide shows that blue is beginning to make an incursion right on the equator off the west coast of South America and all the way to the international dateline in the center of the Pacific Ocean. And if that becomes increasingly blue, that is colder than usual, and increasingly, let's say, rosy to red north of Australia, we could be right back in the La Nina-type conditions, which we saw during the past 2.5 years. Well, we hope that isn't the case. But as the next slide shows, the tendency, if we don't know where we're going, and there's no real reason to think it would go one way or the other, on the left part of the graph of the multivariate ENSO index, it showed that things moved into blue between 1950 and 1976 or so. That is the droughty for the Midwest and wet for Montana. La Nina, just because it occurred most of the time. So if you didn't know if El Nino or La Nina was coming, it would go one way or the other, but probably during those years to the harsh side for the Corn Belt. During the next years from 1976 up to 2006 or 7, the tendency was to be dominated by the favorable for the Midwest El Nino side of things. We have shifted back, it appears, on the lower right of the figure, to we would have to anticipate if we're at neutral, that the tendency would be to go back to what we would call the unfavorable, for the Midwest at least, condition of La Nina. And that might be considered favorable for the Canadian prairies and for the Montana area, where the winters tend to get more snow. The next slide has to do with the volatility of yields. You see right in the middle of the slide, over 1980, a great deal of volatility of yields from year to year. This for Iowa. It looks looks the same, although the actual bushel numbers are a little different. If we looked at the corn yield for the nation, years of volatility. Also, it was volatile around 1940, before and after, all the way through the middle of the 50s. And then I have some brackets in there that show some years of very consistent yield. Consistent, but increasing over 1960 period. And the yield going up, and not much volatility from year to year. By the way, there wasn't much volatility in your winter heating bill, or your summer cooling bill, if you were a person that cooled in the summer. And the same was going on over the year 2000. I have a dashed line that touches the top of all of these yields. That is the realized potential yield for corn. If the national corn doesn't come up and hit its dashed line, the Iowa corn yield doesn't come up and hit this dashed line, it was because the weather was not ideal for the crop. And you see, it's only been ideal a few years. But I want you to look at that time of volatility over 1980. It was 25 years. The one over 1940 was 25 years. The one off the left, the four stable period number two, was 25 years. The first time of high volatility was 25 years. For some reason, we've had four of them since we began keeping records in 1864 or so, and they've all been 25 years in length, with four periods of consistent yields, 18 years in length. The year we have just experienced was year 19. We have reason to think we're about to go into 25 years of the volatility that you see expressed over 1980. All of the risk management that you have done with crop management, with cattle management, with using insurance, with choosing fertilizer, with choosing hybrids, choosing rangeland to use, all of this risk management, including especially your insurance program, has just been practice for what we expect during the next 25 years. That is without any climate change. That's just what we expect with the climate we've been living with for the last 100 years. Some people say the climate is changing. Don't expect that that would make it less of an effect. Well, the climate has always changed. It will always change. The question is how much, how fast, how come. But during the next 25 years, we do anticipate that we will be in a very different type of climate from what you experienced the last 18, but not extraordinary. We do know how to handle it. Well, if you'd like to contact me, there is my email address. I always put changes on Twitter, just a sentence, but you can click on that sentence and see a page full of details. I hope that your risk management goes well.
I'm not really sure whether to say thank you or not. I'm not really sure whether I'm very encouraged by that presentation, but yes, we are thankful for Dr. Taylor's time and that insightful presentation regarding the situation that we're in and what may lay ahead. Again, Dr. Taylor is unable to join us live today for questions, but he did provide his contact information there on the slide, and feel free to email Dr. Taylor directly if you have questions for him. With that, I think we'll move on to the next presenter,